Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with my book, Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks, we're ready for Chapter 5, Logan's Light. Logan, 1973. I first saw Logan when Halpern, Gary, Mike, and I snowshoed into the Lucania steel saddle in 1967, and I had not forgotten. My etched memory fueled a dream and an obsession. Canada's highest mountain, 19,540-foot Mount Logan, is not easily visible from civilization. Its monumental mass rises in secretive splendor in the heart of the St. Elias Range in Canada's Yukon Territory. Logan, North America's second highest peak, is only 780 feet lower than Denali's sovereign summit in Alaska. Denali is visible from much of south-central Alaska and has received ample attention. I climbed Denali in 1963 and was well aware of the virtues and hazards of North America's highest peak. While lower than Denali, I knew that Logan magnified many of Denali's splendors and terrors. Logan was more remote than Denali, and our isolation would be exquisite. I liked that. Denali rises above tundra, but Logan rises in the center of North America's largest ice fields. You could walk away from Logan for many miles in any direction on ice. Logan is colder than Denali. I liked that. Logan is closer than Denali to the Gulf of Alaska and its ever-swirling storms. I did not like that. Logan is a larger mountain than Denali. It is Logan's shape that makes it so huge. It looks like a table with a summit plateau 10 miles long and up to 3 miles wide. Logan's plateau supports 11 summits, including 3 over 19,000 feet and another 6 over 18,000 feet. Even Denali cannot match that statistic. Logan didn't have just a singular upward thrust. It displayed its height over a large area. But Logan's accolades continued. If you sliced Logan flat at 16,000 feet, the resulting plateau would cover 30 square miles. It is 100 miles around the base of Logan. Best of all, there were no cities on Logan. I liked Logan. Barb and I had planned our Logan expedition for a year before a round-the-world climbing trip that we called Odyssey, and now watched in wonderment as our dreams became reality. Logan was Odyssey's highest and most important peak. I vowed to climb Logan without taking anything from the medical kit, not even an aspirin or a piece of tape. At the end of May, Barb and I met 5 other team members in Seattle. With Paul Simon's song Kodachrome blaring on the radio, an expansive Jerry Hinkle drove our rented van south to my old friend Rainier for our team-building tune-up climb. Riding next to Hinkle in front of the van, I recalled the trip in 1964 when a storm trapped me in a steam cave for 2 nights on Rainier's 14,410-foot summit. 8 of us almost died. I had not forgotten Das Cave and knew that Jerry's indomitable humor would be a valuable asset on this trip. As we cruised toward the beautiful but dangerous Rainier, Hinkle mused, "I wonder if mountains have memories." We packed up to a secure high camp and the next day climbed the Führer Finger Couloir, which is to the west of the Nisqually ice fall that I had climbed in 1964 en route to our ordeal in Das Cave. When we got to 13,000 feet, our route joined the upper part of the route that I had taken in 1964, and I couldn't believe what I saw on the summit. I watched a lenticular cloud grow over Columbia Crest, and Das Cave's smell rushed back. After watching the cloud grow for 10 minutes, a sure sign of impending bad weather, I said to Hinkle, "Rainier remembers me." I was not going to let a cave trap me again, so changing the Das Cave script, I turned my team around and we hurried back to camp. A fast-moving storm tormented the summit during the night, but the next morning was clear. So using our extra day and our conditioning, We reascended the route all the way to the summit. The message was clear. If you are in good shape, you can exercise other choices. After years of climbing in the Cascades, Barb and I finished our 6 Washington major peaks together with whoops and frosty kisses. But there was no sunbathing on this summit. Appropriately cooling us down for Logan, Rainier's summit was raw and windy. As we huddled just below the highest point in our parkas, Charlie Campbell said, "Heavy duty! This is awesome!" I chuckled, "Charlie, Rainier is just our tune-up. Logan is 10 times this." Charlie fell silent, but looked deeply determined. Back in Seattle, we made last-minute adjustments to our gear, strapped our snowshoes together in one big bundle that we could check on the plane, and headed for the airport. We hit a patch of trouble in Whitehorse, the Yukon's capital city. The airlines lost Bill Glinkman's pack on his flight north, and this was a potential triple wipeout for Bill. 4 months before the Logan trip, Bill, a.k.a. the Singing Tiger, was in a near-fatal car accident. As he recovered, he vowed that he would climb Logan. He now stood to lose his gear and his Logan climb, and fail on his vow. After several days, the airline still had no trace of Bill's pack. He was tired of hearing lame excuses like, "I'm sorry, sir, perhaps your pack was sent to Hang Ten too far." Bill was despondent and wanted to quit the climb, but our team tackled the problem like a crux pitch. Bill had his boots and snowshoes, which was a good start. We all pitched in gear from our bulging packs full of extras and scrounged a few items locally. Emergency telephone calls home launched a long-distance shopping expedition, and soon a package was on its way. Bill would wait a few days for the vital package, then fly in after the rest of us. While we waited in Burwash Landing on the Alaska Highway, I was well aware that this was the outpost that Washburn and Bates had struggled to reach in 1937 after their epic retreat from Lucania and Steele. I could not see the great peaks from Burwash, but knowing that we were poised on the edge of a vast wilderness, I began my nervous pacing. Finally, we flew southwest toward Logan on a sparkling clear day. As the overpowering mountain approached, I did not know whether to whoop, roar, cringe, or cry. We flew past Logan's entire north face while the massive mountain floated outside the plane window like a specter. Logan to the left, Lucania and Steele to the right. I was euphoric since I was finally continuing the transcendent climb that I had begun 6 years earlier on Lucania. We landed in King Trench near Logan's west edge. My first impression of Logan was cold, and this was just base camp. The main summit was 15 miles away near the plateau's eastern edge. The regular route was easy, but cold, high, windy, and long. We had much hard work to do to achieve our various vows. We spent a week ferrying loads up King Trench to 14,000-foot King Call between Logan and the neighboring 16,972-foot King Peak. After our 3-month tune-up, I was in great shape and savored the labor. I just enjoyed the simple act of going up. Rarely in life can we apply so much energy to an uncomplicated task, and the results were impressive. Bill Hammond and I carried 5 food bags each, claimed the expedition heavy carry record, and talked about our famous carry in hushed tones. At the end of the week, we retreated to the landing site to welcome the Singing Tiger to Logan. When he stepped out of the plane, he looked ragtag in his mismatched gear, but he was singing again. 2 days later, we just beat a major storm to King Call. While it snowed hard, we hunkered down, rested, ate, and passed the time by setting speed records for opening brown bread cans with tiny Army-issue can openers. I grew up using these can openers and held the record of 12 seconds. Near the end of the storm, Bob Cormack announced an astonishing 9-second time, but I did not witness the alleged event and knew that it was a lie. Lying on a peak is not the same as lying about a peak, but it is a step in that direction. In any case, lying on an expedition is unacceptable. Would Bob's cry of "on belay" actually mean "off belay"? It was no longer clear, and I questioned my decision to invite him on this trip. When the storm finally fizzled, we twitched with uphill energy. When we could see, we went like jackrabbits, since bad weather was the norm on Logan. Our daily routine of carrying a load or two, cooking, eating, and sleeping was beautiful in its simplicity. Climbing Logan was about as innocent as adult life can be. We had removed our minds and bodies from the rest of the world and its crowded cities. Logan's bountiful beauty slowly seduced us higher. We had our own name for every feature of our climb. With seven people contributing ideas, we had seven different themes. King Trench had Trenchfoot Camp and Kipper Camp. The crevasse above King Call was the ninth hole. We found few crevasses on the route, but were always on the lookout for dangerous hidden holes. Steep but short Two Wand Hill was followed by Heavy Duty Hill. If we felt the need for a little entertainment, we would just name our own. It wasn't time yet to create a mock city. That would happen on the plateau. So our next camp was just the end zone at 15,500 feet. This spacious camp was under 17,651-foot Queen Peak, one of Logan's 11 summits. The entire area around the end zone had a great view across King Call to King Peak and beyond to the famous 18,008-foot Mount St. Elias, the Transcendent Range's namesake peak. The weather gods gave us a clear day in the end zone, and we inhaled the views. The sun dropped below the northern horizon for less than 6 hours at night, and we never had complete darkness. We could climb for many hours and would even climb through the night if we needed to. The temperature had done nothing but drop since base camp, and by the end zone it went well below 0 degrees Fahrenheit at night. Since we were on an easy route, well equipped, and moving slowly toward the summit, Logan's cold kept us close to camp at night. When the shadows found our camp and the temperature started down, we found our places in our large tents and warmed them with our stoves as we prepared huge meals. The meal was not complete until each tent's stuffed occupants uttered the nightly groan. Some nights we treated the air to a round and sometimes a chorus. Barb's and my sleeping bags were a little skimpy for Logan's severe cold. So before retiring, I plumped my down bag for several minutes. The vigorous action warmed me and moved the insulation to the most important places. Barb achieved the same objective by doing 50 sit-ups in her bag. Normally, we zipped our bags together, but high on Logan, the doubled bags let in too many drafts, so we contented ourselves with down-plumped external cuddling. Above the end zone was the mile-long football field that led up to the 18,200-foot pass that separated us from Logan's huge summit plateau. We dubbed it Pass Go, and it was a major milestone on our climb. Pass Go separated two of Logan's 11 summits, 18,438-foot Ina Peak to the northwest and 18,517-foot Prospector's Peak to the southeast. Beyond Pasco, we would be committed to the plateau for our summit push. It would be colder still, and we would have to climb up to escape. The major question for our team was whether we could continue the high level of comfort, safety, and humor that we had maintained so far. Before we left the end zone, another storm helped us answer our question. It snowed 2 inches per hour for 2 days until our universe was half snow and half air. When we got tired of hunkering in the tents, we went out to shovel and play in the poofy powder that skiers pay big money to find. Cries of "heavy duty" and "awesome" filled the snow air. When the storm faded to nothing more than tinkling ice crystals in the now still air, we struggled up the football field in the new snow, crossed Pasco, and committed to the plateau. Touchdown! We satirized our lost city life by calling our first plateau camp Fat City, Our humor held, but we were still miles from the summit. The temperature dropped to minus 40 degrees, and another storm moved in. By now, we were a well-oiled cold weather team and took our fat city life in stride until we had an unexpected visitor. A small bird fluttered around Fat City in desperation. Blown by the winds, it was 100 miles off course and approached our colorful tents as a last hope. Exhausted, it finally landed. We cared for it as best we could, but it did not survive the night. The tiny creature's final flight was not in vain, for it reminded us of Logan's hazard and isolation, and that this much freedom often carries a price. Beyond these obvious messages lay a deeper lesson. Peace is not guaranteed, and this bird's poignant voyage deepened my commitment to my growing climb for peace. Summit window. I had long dreamed about and willed for a 3-day summit window of glorious weather. Barb and I had talked about it often. When the storm cleared and Logan gave us a summit invitation, I looked at Barb and said softly, "One." That day, we pitched a secure high camp 4 miles closer to the summit at 18,600 feet. High camp on Logan is often the highest camp on North America. We were out of all cities now. We're even out of our own Fat City, although it was still in sight across Logan's Pancake Plateau. To accent our isolation, we called our high camp High Over Boulder. We were finally achieving a life balance where we could embrace all good things. We were poised, but would we get our summit stroll? Would the weather hold? Early the next morning, July 10, the sun on the tent answered our question. At 4 a.m., I crawled over the mounds of down that held my sleeping companions and poked my head outside the tent door. Clear! Then I checked the thermometer hanging in the sun. It was minus 25 degrees. Ouch! I did not want our summit climb to be frostbite city. Today we had to be extra careful, so I crawled back into my down to give Logan another hour to warm up. At 5 a.m., I checked again, but it was minus 30 degrees. However, the sky was transparent. Without mentioning the temperature drop, I nuzzled close to Barb and whispered, "Two." Then I woke camp with, "Wee honkin'! Crystal clear! Time for our summit stroll!" Logan's main summit was beyond the closer west peak, and we skirted this summit on its north side to avoid any unnecessary elevation gain. After marching for an hour around the west peak, we gathered for a candy and conversation break. After the congenial blast of sugar, I strode off into the lead with renewed enthusiasm. We were on a stroll and a roll. The weather was pristine. A few steps beyond our picnic site, Logan evaporated beneath my feet, and I fell free through air, not a freedom I wanted. As I plummeted into the dreaded hidden crevasse, my mind screamed, "Oh no, the slack!" Because we had congregated during our break, the rope was not yet tight between Barb and me. As I fell, I flashed on Mike Humphrey's fall into Hinge Hole on Lucania and hoped for a happy ending. I fell far too long as the slack snaked away at Barb's feet. Finally, the rope jerked me to a spastic stop. My hat covered my eyes, but I didn't have to see to realize that I was in deep danger. I shoved my hat back and glanced up. 40 feet of taut rope reached up to the hole where I had plunged into my snow-covered trap. Below, the dark abyss breathed frigid air, and I was riding a breath that could easily be my last. This was not a downy dream. I was inside Logan. Our summit stroll had taken a malicious turn. Inside Logan, the rest of the world came rushing back with a binary click. It was time for careful, focused action. In the sealed crevasse, the air temperature was Logan's average annual temperature at 19,000 feet, which was minus 45 degrees. As the deep cold probed my bare hand, I remembered how warm it had been in the tent. I pulled my mitten from my parka pocket, knowing that I would lose fingers to frostbite if I dropped it. Carefully, ice axe dangling from my other hand, I pulled on my precious mitten. I heard my companions yelling above, but they could not hear me, since sound travels into snow but not out of it. Twisted, my first attempts to get upright failed. The long snowshoes strapped across my pack jammed between the walls of my narrow crevasse, and this serious impediment became extreme when my companions pulled on the rope. With my snowshoes jammed, their pulling just turned me upside down. My camera and pack straps inched toward my neck and started to choke me. I had to do something dramatic and fast. This was no longer a stroll, it was survival. I reached up, grabbed the rope, made a tough twisting move, and slipped out of my pack. My choking camera strap fortuitously broke, and I ended up with ice axe, pack, and broken camera strap clutched in one hand. It never crossed my mind to take a picture. As my companions heaved, I continued to turn upside down while clinging desperately to my pack below me. My pack contained survival equipment. I could not drop it. Yet. Upside down, I clawed at the ice with my crampons and somehow freed my pack. I wondered how much more I could do when I remembered all the training I had done for Odyssey. I was strong. Pulling and twisting, I finally managed to right myself, get into a chimney position across the narrow crevasse, and get my pack into my lap. Frigid air rushed from below like a portent. I looked down into the darkening abyss and saw a death worse than what I had faced in Das Cave on Rainier. This was clearly Logan's summit test. Our stroll had been too easy. Was Logan going to gobble me up? I looked up and started chimneying toward the tiny spot of light. As I chimneyed to the rhythm of my pulling teammates, I steadily lost my grip on my gear. I knew that, if it came to it, I would let the camera go first, then my axe, and hold my pack to the end. When I was 10 feet below the hole, I finally established voice contact with Singing Tiger above. When Bill heard me yelling, he hollered into the hole, "Jerry! Are you all right?" Struggling to keep from losing my various grips, emotional as well as physical, I shouted evenly, "Catch the camera!" Maintaining a tenuous grip on my pack, I knew that I only had one option to save my camera, and that was to throw the camera out of the hole with my right hand. My dangling ice axe complicated the toss considerably. I had to keep my swing well clear so my axe would not catch on my clothing or my pack, and I also had to keep the broken camera strap from catching on the axe. I carefully computed my camera's fate, lowered my right hand, and peered up. I had one chance. Whoosh! My camera sailed up through the hole into Logan's light and plop, landed at Singing Tiger's feet. My delivery from the depths amazed everyone, and it was certainly a sign that I was alive. Barb said later that our camera flying out of Logan was the best sight that she had ever seen. My next problem was that the rope disappeared into the snow 8 feet below the hole, in spite of the ice axe that the others had placed under the rope near the hole to prevent this problem. All the pulling had trenched the rope deep into the snow. Solving this problem, Singing Tiger lowered me a second rope and pulled my pack out. Finally unencumbered, I thought that I could just muscle out the last few feet. Ha! I got my head through the hole, then the deeply buried rope from below stopped me. Even with a second rope, the crevasse still had me. I peered back into the abyss and wondered again what Logan wanted of me. Just then, Bill Hammond marched up with his unspoken passion and began cutting away the snow that trapped the rope and me. I just gasped, "Don't cut the ropes!" As Bill chopped with steady, careful energy, I was glad that I had invited him on the trip. An hour after I fell in, I crawled back into Logan's light to the cheers of my tired companions. Looking like a frozen ghost, I offered the best yodel that I could muster. After a short rest, we continued toward the summit. Strangely, we did not name my crevasse. It was mine alone, and to me it felt unnameably deep. Our last steps to Logan's summit were sublime. On top at last, we congregated in a gangly mass of cheers, whoops, thumps, and photos. We congratulated Singing Tiger on his triple victory. He was clearly a tiger, but we insisted that he live up to the other half of his title. He obliged with his unique monotone song. The tiger's single off-key ohm note floated free into the transcendent range. Infected by my enthusiasm, Charlie tried to yodel. Inspired by Charlie's enthusiasm, I let loose with my very own heavy duty. Bob, ever the engineer, set up his camera on automatic for our team photo. Hinkle cemented our perspective with his laughter. Logan Summit thrilled Barb and me. After pulling ice out of my beard, I gave her a big summit smooch. It was a perfect day, and the St. Elias Range basked in all its grandeur. We clearly saw every peak from 15,300-foot Mount Fairweather in southeast Alaska, 150 miles away, to 16,390-foot Mount Blackburn in the Wrangell Mountains. I saluted my old Yukon friends Lucania and Steele to the north, since I considered this climb to be an extension of my Lucania expedition. St. Elias, definitely a peak that would require a separate expedition, sparkled to the south. Logan granted us one of the best summit views that I had ever seen. Just before descending, I realized that I had now climbed North America's three highest peaks, Denali, Logan, and Orizaba, and all had offered me transcendent summits. We went back to high camp over the top of Logan's 19,488-foot West Peak, a.k.a. Philippe Peak, as the sun and temperature slowly sank. Back in our high-over boulder camp, a tired Singing Tiger said, "Roach, you are the only person I know who would climb a 19,000-foot mountain just to avoid a crevasse." I replied, "Yeah, there is profit in crevasses. I had to cancel my fall with a climb, so we got two summits for the price of one." The morning sun prompted a whispered, "Three." Then Barb and I snuggled in for more downy dreams. Our incredible weather window held, and I knew that this was an incredible gift from the weather gods. As we descended, Logan's snow twinkled at me, and I winked back at Logan's light. Lower down, I heard a few strains of Bach from another team's shortwave radio, and the combination of Bach and Logan stirred deep emotions. After we raced into base camp with much singing, I turned to greet Barb, but to my surprise, she was crying. She had climbed Logan in fine style, but the effort had exhausted her. It was time to return to some of life's other simple pleasure. Our Logan climb was a howling success, and true to my vow, I used neither aspirin nor tape. During our 35 days on Canada's highest mountain, we lived simply, and our life felt balanced. Logan offered a cold but beautiful fourth movement to my Northern Mountain Symphony. At age 29, I had now climbed North America's Big Three and seven of her 10 highest peaks. However, I had now seen King Peak and St. Elias, and was not sure I could ever climb those tough peaks. Then, there was 4 Acre. Stay tuned for Chapter 6 from Northern Heights, Archangel, 4 Acre, 1975.